The following edition of the Hydrogen Elevator is brought to you by the Smarter E-Europe, Europe's largest trade fair alliance for the energy industry. The Hydrogen Elevator, the Hydrogen Podcast in cooperation with H2, the Hydrogen Magazine. And here is your host, Jürgen Pfeiffer.
Moin, and a very warm welcome to a new episode of the Hydrogen Elevator, your favorite hydrogen podcast in cooperation with H2, the Hydrogen Magazine. I'm Jürgen Pfeiffer, and once again a month, I take you as your hydrogen lift boy through a building that is being heavily renovated right now and which some of the tenants don't even know which floor they are standing on. We want to change that a little bit, and if you want to know more after this ride, you read up in H2, Germany's leading hydrogen magazine. This episode today is a little special. We are recording live from a transparent cube here in Hall B1 of the Smarter Europe, and what you hear in the back is not noise. It is the strongly beating international heartbeat of the world's biggest fair in renewable energies in Munich. Today's topic has maximum political charge and only sounds abstract on the surface. Between H2 Global and H2 Local, what partnership strategy does Europe need? And to answer that question thoroughly, I have two guests in the lift with me today who couldn't be more different. And that's why we fit together so well. But more on that in a moment. I want to start with a number, $6. $6 per kilogram. That is roughly what green hydrogen costs to produce today, even in good locations, according to DNV's Energy Transition Outlook. The dream of the $1 dessert kilo? That is not today. That's the target for 2030s, and some other projections say not before 2050. Meanwhile, in Germany, under the 2030 rules, the European Resilience Alliance puts the delivered cost at around 11 euros a kilo against roughly 6 in Spain. So the logic still seems obvious: produce where it's cheap and ship it to where it's needed. But there's a smaller twist that makes today's conversation really interesting, because as the latest DNV Energy Transition Outlook published this spring puts it, that cost advantage largely evaporates at the point of use. The Middle East and North Africa do produce $1 to $2 a kilo cheaper than Europe. But once you add conversion, shipping, storage and reconversion, DNV says that gap is, and I quote, largely filled by the cost of logistics. The desert bargain eaten up on the way to the factory gate. And all of this happens against a brutal backdrop. The Strait of Hormuz has been effectively closed since last February, and it is still closed and perhaps reopened as we record this. But anyway, it shows clearly enough, energy security is no longer a seminar topic, it's a kitchen table topic. So the question is not just local or global, it is what kind of partnerships keep Europe safe and supplied without trading or dependencies for the next. That's the ride today in the Hydrogen Elevator. My first guest did not come to hydrogen as a chemist, but as a banker. 10 years at Deutsche Bank, once the youngest board member of its Italian group before he traded the trading floor for the desert. For 15 years now, he's been building the bridge between North African and Middle Eastern sun and European industry. He's the CEO of DII Desert Energy and chair of the MENA Hydrogen Alliance, the man the Gulf calls when it gets serious about molecules. And he doesn't do small talk. Ask him who he is, and he will tell you straight-faced, I climbed a lot of difficult mountains and survived. I'm a person with values, so I never compromise. End of quote. And his bet is not modest either. He's convinced hydrogen will become, in his words, bigger than oil and gas combined. Very warm welcome to the lift, Cornelius Matthes.
Thank you very much. Really glad to be here.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. My second guest is, if you like, the diplomat of the hydrogen world, an engineer with a doctorate from Grenoble who started his career in steel at ArcelorMittal, then spent $2 at France's National Research Center, the CEA, first running its hydrogen and fuel cell lab, then a division of 180 people. Today, he's executive director of the IPHE, the International Partnership for Hydrogen and Fuel Cells, which is a polite name for one of the hardest jobs in the industry, getting 27 governments plus European Commission to agree on how we even count a clean molecule. Because without shared rules, there is no global market, only 27 local ones. A very warm welcome, Dr. Laurent Antony.
Thank you very much for the nice words.
Great to have you with us. As always, we open up this podcast with the H2 Impulse from the editorial team of our cooperation partner, H2, the Hydrogen Magazine. And This week, the H2 editors go right to the nerve of today's topic with some history. Back in the 2000s, desert tech was a mostly German idea. Harness green energy for the world in the deserts of Africa. Today, DII Desert Energy, which grew out of desert tech, includes companies from the MENA region and other continents. And the picture on the ground has shifted too. German companies still provide key components for NEOM, but in Oman, projects are built by the Indian developer Axmir with electrolyzers from China. So the H2 editor's impulse question straight to you, Cornelius, does Germany still play a role in green hydrogen from the desert?
Well, NEOM Green Hydrogen is the world's largest that was effectively originated out of our group, which made us kind of proud. We hosted the first discussions in 2017 when we said we need to do something really bold, and the project effectively is bold. It's a 2,200 megawatt electrolyzer, which are, as you rightly say, delivered 100% from Germany, ThyssenKrupp Nucera. And, well, there is 1,700 megawatt winds, there is solar, there is also, by the way, ammonia tank delivered by a company called Steiner from Germany. So there's many components, and this is the world's largest, it's the most important reference, and most of all, it is due to be commissioned in the next few quarters. So it is 95% complete. So I would say definitely for now, Germany plays a big role. Europe in general plays a big role, but you should not be complacent. It is very important to defend this leadership, and the world moves on very quickly.
Same question to you, Laurent, because this is your world, one to open with you too. According to the latest DNV Outlook, citing your own IPHA inventory, there are new around 30 different hydrogen certification schemes in the world, 30, and still no harmonized global standard. So is the real barrier to a global hydrogen market still the price, or is it that we cannot even agree on what a clean molecule should be like?
I think the second point, as you are mentioning, the cost, of course, really is important. But what really today, I would say, slows down the market, first we need to create that market, is to ensure interoperability, which means we need to agree not only on standards, not only on certification, but first on terminology. First, we need all to speak the same language. And that's why at IPHA, we've developed this so-called certification 101 paper, so that first, to understand each other, we need to speak the same language. So let's read, use the same words, have the common understanding, and then, of course, see about the definitions. What does clean, low emissions, low carbon, renewable hydrogen mean? It can be different from one country to the other. And that's why we need really to work on this interoperability. And as you mentioned, this latest report, we are assessing 21 certification schemes plus 7 support mechanisms. And we saw that finally there are so many differences. And the more you are looking in details, the more different it is.
Have you got an idea about how much paper that is?
But yes, but it's not a problem of how much paper. But the problem is really we need to agree on, using the same words, what is common, what is different, and build on these commonalities. And that's why we need to see what are the common points, agree on the common terminology, and then have not a unique approach, because many people may say, let's have one unique certification scheme. That's just a dream. Because I think certification are only here to ensure you are compliant with existing regulations. But if the regulations are different, you cannot have a common certification scheme. That's why we need to see what is common. And in particular, one thing is common. Everyone relies on the carbon footprint of your hydrogen.
Just help me understand. How could we possibly make the CO2 reduction scheme being accounted to the different sectors and companies when they do the decarbonization work, when they invest and decarbonize, let's say, cement industry, whatever, when the end of the decarbonization process is only bilaterally respected and not the process in between? How can we probably solve that? Because that's an financial aspect, and nobody will invest in technology if he doesn't get his fair share in accountability issues.
That's exactly. So IPHA is only dealing with hydrogen and hydrogen derivatives, not with cement. But if you are using low emissions hydrogen, I prefer to use the IEA wording. It's low emissions hydrogen. We need to agree on a common calculator. And that's why exactly IPHE, I've proposed that work October 19, started the work on the IPHE in January 2020. And then with at least more than 15 countries, we had more than 70 meetings to agree on a common methodology to quantify the greenhouse gas emissions for hydrogen, regardless the primary energy used, regardless production pathway.
It's not Formula One speed, right?
It was a long-lasting discussion, exchange between governments. But in 2023, we released the third version. But IPHE is only a government-to-government partnership, not ruling anyone, just providing recommendations. And this paper has been used as a seed document for an ISO standard, which has been published late this April. So now we have one ISO standard where we can use to have the same approach about system boundary, allocation, and even we're including CapEx emissions, which are usually totally forgotten. And then you may use it either as, I would say, a way to quantify for certification, or at least to use it as a comparator, as a translator, as it has really been very important to be mentioned. An ISO standard is a voluntary technical standard which cannot overrule any existing regulations. But it is a tool that you can compare apples with apples. And if you compare in a trusted manner, then you can really build partnerships. And I think today, maybe one point we can discuss, I think maybe better than local versus local, is that the difference between partner and supplier. And we do not have to mix, because if we mix in Europe, is mixing suppliers and partners, we will just run the same dependency as we have today with fossil fuels.
As the main question today is between ReArm and Repower EU, what is the strategic role of hydrogen for Europe? Let's set the poles of the debate clearly, 90 seconds each of you. Cornelius, perhaps you first, because you are the global one in the room. The II was built on a simple, powerful idea. The deserts of the world can power the industries of Europe. In one sentence, why is important not a dependency, but a partnership?
Well, it is to transfer technology from Europe to the region, which is Europe's opportunity. This creates jobs, creates stability in the region, and people will profit. The pressure of migration will decrease. And then on the other hand, the region will be a reliable supplier for Europe. And this supply of low emission molecules and electrons will provide a stable revenue source. That's basically the whole concept. And the region is broad. It's more than 20 countries. So we're not getting dependent from a European point of view on one supplier like Russia. So it's well diversified. It's resilient, and it's just there, and infrastructure is there, like for example gas pipelines which can be converted. So I think that's briefly it.
Laurent, the counter role perhaps also in one sentence, in every country, if every country writes its own rule book, does global hydrogen then even has a chance?
Yes, I would say yes, in a sense that we understand each other, and that's why it was really focusing on this common language. If we use a common language, if we understand each other, if we put in place some harmonized standards or calculator, comparator, then we can create a global market. Because I think trade, no, everything can be traded. You just have to agree about the price you want to buy it. But we have to work about tradability of certified low emissions hydrogen. And that's why we need to have these common aspects and that we understand each other, and then we can compare, we can exchange, we can work together, even if the rules are not totally the same, at least at the beginning.
And let me maybe add one point. You mentioned trade, Laurent. It is very important that it's not only the trade of the physical product hydrogen, it's also a virtual trade, it's certificates, because this could help really to kickstart a market similar to renewable electricity, where you have virtual power purchase agreements, and it would also avoid unnecessary transport from the start.
So maybe I can react about what you're mentioning, this virtual. Not at the beginning, because we need to create trust, and to create trust, we need to ensure traceability. That the molecule, the hydrogen molecule, the derivatives you are producing, selling, buying, using, is really low emissions. And that's why, as mentioned, Europe, many other countries are based on mass balancing. So you have a physical link between the molecule you're producing and the molecule you are using. And this book can claim with no physical relation, I'm not sure it's currently the right solution. So So that's, I would say, a position with many countries. So it's not my personal position that many countries are taking today.
Okay, understood the point. Cornelius, we started with the DNV study, and I quoted it saying the logistics eat the bargain, conversion to ammonia shipping, reconversion, and so on. And suddenly desert hydrogen costs what German electrolyzers would. So be honest with me, where exactly does the import case is still a winner? And where is it just a story we perhaps tell ourselves?
Yeah, well, first of all, the numbers, absolute, something like 6 kilograms are significantly too high. So we can go below 3 euros per kilogram today. And NEOM Green Hydrogen is there today. So I think it's a relatively simple modeling. More than 60% is obviously electricity, as we all know. And then you can model it and the cost of transport, I think, via the various carriers, they're well known as well. So I think on that question, there is, first of all, the today's situation that Europe, I mentioned, is 80% molecules and 20% electrons. And most, a vast majority of the 80% is simply imported. So I think there is a logical case to step-by-step replace these imports with low-emission molecules. That's all about. That's for security of supply. But of course, this is to partly work on today's situation. And the question is from an economic point of view. So I think the potential to produce domestically in Europe due to the lack of space, for example, first of all, but also to the lack of economics will be limited by definition to a certain degree. And then if you combine economical factors, if you combine proximity, existing infrastructure which can be reconverted, like the existing gas pipelines, with the technology transfer, with the aim to create stability in the countries, I think these are many factors which contribute to build a very strong case for these partnerships, at least with the MENA region, which is Europe's natural neighbor.
But hands down, doesn't every molecule imported from the MENA region still has the risk of transport, just to mention Hormuz, still closed today? And doesn't every shipping import come naturally with that kind of danger and fragility? And is that not one of those points that are lingering on every partnership without having the secure level of transport?
Yeah, I would say that's why I think it's neither local nor global. It's both of them. And where you are speaking about dependency, what is important is to create partners in different regions of the world. Then you have diversification of supply with trusted partners, in which you are not, as mentioned at the beginning, not suppliers, partners. And we can maybe deep dive a little what is the difference between a supplier and a partner. But diversification of supply will then, I would say, reduce your dependency. And as mentioned, with partners, not with suppliers, since you may create new dependency.
Yeah, well, let me maybe explain that Hormuz is more or less only relevant for fossil molecules, because on green hydrogen, this is almost not relevant on the east coast of Saudi Arabia, because the green hydrogen is all on the west coast, which is effectively at the Red Sea. And NEOM, by the way, is close to Suez. It's on the border of Egypt. So we are far away from Hormuz, and we're also far away, you know, from the area around the Horn of Africa with Yemen. So, I will refer to North Africa also specifically, countries like Morocco, Algeria, Egypt. So they are much closer, and they're obviously not affected by Hormuz. They're very far from all of that. And so Hormuz, I think, is just a wake-up call how fragile particularly the fossil value chains are and how dependent we are on them, and we are really suffering all the effects.
Laurent mentioned the trust. When we talk about trust, it's also the certificate issue, because if a kilo of ammonia leaves Oman as green but arrives in Rotterdam as perhaps not quite compliant, everybody will probably lose the exporter, the importer, the climate. How can we change that trouble in terms of compliancy and certificates?
as mentioned, certificates are here to ensure you are compliant with the local regulations. So, to avoid, I would say, that you consume time, because if you say you are producing a molecule in Oman and you ship it to Europe, but if they do not have the same regulations, not to the same way to quantify the greenhouse gas emissions. For instance, if you look at that specific attribute, then you have to do the exercise twice. One in Oman, where maybe you can receive some subsidies depending on the local regulation, but to be recognized as a RFNBO, you need to follow the European delegated acts and directives to be recognized as a RFNBO. So to avoid this loss of time and of money, that's why it's important to work on these mutual recognitions of certification schemes. But here, to avoid misunderstanding, it's not to have one certification scheme, but IPHE is promoting a modular approach. Look what is common, work on these commonalities, and look what is the impact on the tradability. It is a low impact, not a high impact, and let's agree by understanding each other among governance, how can we agree, find a consensus that these commonalities are bigger and more numerous in order then to facilitate tradability of clean certified hydrogen? So this is exactly, I would say, the topic of IPHE. Discuss together, ensure we understand each other, agree or propose some common approaches like modular approach, like a digital product passport. We also discussed on this topic that you can trust the data transfer from the producer to the user, and then see how we can all agree. And this should facilitate tradability and then the creation of a market.
A question from my understanding, and let's view the telescope around from global to local. From the desert model to work, Europe has to commit to buying, I think, for roughly 20 years. Brussels can barely commit to 20 months. Why would any Gulf investor build a multi-billion dollar plant for Europe when Asia signs faster and asks fewer questions?
Yeah, well, I think Asia, obviously, for example, on blue is a bit more relaxed and a bit more keen. Well, I think this is for any long-term agreement for renewable, solar, wind, as longer the tenor, as longer the commitment, the better the business case. It's simply a mathematical calculation. So 10 years is not so good. 20 years is super. If you have 30 years, it's even much better. And it simply improves your financial model. So a solid offtake, a solid long-term agreement is simply a prerequisite to make any of these projects bankable. I don't know any Gulf investor that would just bet on whatever price in the future and just sell to the market, a market, by the way, which is not existing today. So I think we all agree we need this commitment, but the commitment comes indirectly. We need a good regulatory, a pragmatic regulatory framework, a stable, a continuous regulatory framework, which investors trust that will not change in the future. And then the off-takers will move because they know they will need to procure a certain number of low-emission molecules, for example, as simple as it is. But unfortunately, in practice, implementation of that is very slow and very cumbersome and very frustrating to us as well. I clearly get the signals from all the future producers in the MENA region. They're extremely annoyed, extremely frustrated by lack of speed, the lack of clarity, and the lack of continuity from a European point of view for this framework, which is the prerequisite to make the off-takers commit.
Let me point those two positions perhaps a little bit clearer. Cornelius says partnership means importing the cheapest clean molecule. Laurent, you say IPHE philosophy says partnership means shared standards, shared technology, shared value change. So which is it? Is it partner as a supplier or a co-owner? What is it?
Maybe just to react, I fully agree with Cornelius.
Which is bad because you don't disagree.
Sometimes we can agree.
Yeah.
I would agree to say that if you are only based on the cheapest and the easiest molecule to sell, for sure Europe won't receive anyone. They go to Asia. But if you think about, and here we agree, it has to be the most bankable and the most predictable. And that's why long-term commitment and to work on the demand, to have a long-term commitment is very important. And that's why also we need to have long-term, stable, robust rules and not to change every 2 or 3 years. We need to create the trust through long-term commitment. And this is, for example, what Japan is doing with this Hydrogen Society Promotion Act. They are based on CFD, but for 15-year CFD contract plus 10 additional years without CFD, and taking into account that this is also very important, the full supply chain from the producers up to the consumers with all the logistics players in the same project. So you see, that's a nice example how this long-term commitment engaging the full supply chain can really trigger a real hydrogen market.
We are riding toward the top floor, so let's get concrete. The title of this episode has a question, and I want each of you to answer it. What partnership strategy does Europe actually need to be resilient, affordable, and still climate credible? Not the diplomatic answer, perhaps the real one. Who wants to start?
Well, I think from a Gulf, or let's say a MENA region point of view, I already mentioned this, what is expected is a firm commitment. It's a commitment to implement a certain framework, which effectively obliges the off-takers to procure a certain amount of low emission and not full emission molecules. I think this is very clear. This is needed. And then a commitment possibly as well complement infrastructure initiatives, because infrastructure, like for example pipelines, if you convert existing gas pipelines, this will simply not happen without governments, kind of a PPP model you need there. And then I think also another element which is important, governments need to support transfer and delivery of European technology in these countries, for example, with a very competitive ECA coverage, because being competitive, but having finance at all is very important to compete with other countries. Last but not least, I would say that European or, for example, German politics needs to be much more involved, much more active, with a bolder vision to reach these partnerships. So this is really a key engagement. It should be on top of the priority. And if we look at how Europe can maintain its technological edge on certain technologies, this is what needed. It needs bold partnerships and consistent execution.
In your view, Laurent, what partnerships strategy does Europe really need?
So as mentioned, as IPHE, I have many countries, and I do not have to comment any members, I would say, decision. But I can just have, I would say, a global vision and look what works or what could facilitate exchanges and common understanding. And that's why I was focusing at the beginning the difference between partners and suppliers. And if we want to create strong partnerships, we need to see the other as a partner. And that means that we need to see the other as a co-owner, and not as just a partner, as a supplier, and just, for instance, with importing countries, with exporting countries, just to see that as an export dock. No, we need to see these as exporting countries as co-owners, as partners, where we create also common technologies or shared technologies, but also shared standards to impose. That one has not to impose the rules to the others. We need to discuss together. And the other point is also that there is also some local benefits. So that's very important. And not only on technology, also on skills. And as Europe also, I think, but as any country, we need also to rely on our winning hands.
But
technology, for instance, Europe, regarding technology in electrolyzer, but in fuel cells. And here we must say, owing to a decade-long European Commission support for developing hydrogen technology since the 90s, Europe is very strong in technology. So I think
Europe has... But it's not defining itself as a common market. And we have 500 million consumers. We have a very, very... potential power in buying in a global market, and we are not defining ourselves. We're not buying energy on a global basis as Europeans. We do it nationally. We cannibalize France against Germany, vice versa, and stuff like that. If we stay that indifferent, if we stay so unaligned, isn't the partnership logically finished with partners like China who don't have the problem to cooperate differently, to decide in a very different process? Don't we have the problem that others will close partnerships first, especially in Africa?
Why do you say Europe has different rules? For regarding hydrogen, there is one directive for renewables with the delegated act and another one, and delegated act for low carbon hydrogen. So there is a common definition of renewable and low carbon hydrogen. And all European member states have to stick to these European directives and delegated acts. So there is a common rule for Europe.
Okay. Before we step out of the lift, because we have just 1 minute left, what would be, if you could change a single thing tomorrow, one rule, one contract, one decision to make Europe's hydrogen partnerships work, what would it be, Cornelius?
It would be simplicity, and it would be a bold commitment by Europe and the single countries that, for example, need to implement RED III to move ahead and to move ahead in a continuous way.
Laurent?
I would say that if we want to create a hydrogen market, we need to speak the same language and understand each other. This is maybe the most important. Let's understand each other and work together.
Cornelius, Mathis, Laurent, Anthony, thank you both for taking the time for this ride in the hydrogen lift at a moment where the world already, could be a little bit more in better order. Thank you for still believing, despite everything that makes this ramp up so hard, that it keeps moving forward in the right direction. Even if I hope, of course, it's never a substitute for a convincing strategy. Hope is not a substitute for a convincing strategy. We have reached the top floor of this particular ride, but the conversation doesn't end here. It continues, I hope, also within this podcast. Right after a short summer break in September, we are back. And if you and on your various headphones and devices enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and come back to us and recommend us. And if you didn't enjoy it, please tell us that too. We want to hear it, even if it's not comfortable. We promise to do better. We'll see and hear each other again next month. Until then, servus. Don't just do well, do better. Thank you very much for being here, Jürgen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Reich.
You've been listening to The Hydrogen Elevator, the hydrogen podcast in cooperation with H2, the hydrogen magazine, with high-level guests from politics, business, and society, and your host, Jürgen Pfeiffer. Don't forget to stay tuned to The Hydrogen Elevator online at h2.info or h2international.com. And of course, follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram.